Okay, we'll get started now.
So thanks, Stephen. There are a few items in the grocery store as iconic to the American consumer culture as Campbell's soup. It's been a few years, but I've had the privilege of being in an art collector's home to see up close the 32 authentic Campbell soup cans produced by Andy Warhol back in 62. He signed 12 of these cans, one of which was recently valued at $9 million. Critics then talked about how World Works refocused ideas and reflected the depth of the Campbell's brand, and today we have the real Campbell's soup actually using sustainability to refocus ideas and further the relevance of the Campbell's soup brand. Campbell's soup actually sells 2 billion real cans of soup per year, which represents 60% of the so-called wet soup market in the U.S., and a sell-through that reaches 100 million U.S. households per year. Fans would know that chicken noodle and tomato and cream of mushroom are among the top 10 food items sold in grocery stores every week. Annual sales at the 150-year-old Campbell's Soup Company are $8 billion. So there's a lot of touch points for the company in its sustainability challenge. Metal for cans, agricultural practices, supply chain and distribution, GHGs, nutrition and health. Campbell's gives itself a B in its GRI report for 2013. It's a signatory to the UN Global Compact in an act of transparency. It actually has hired Business for Social Responsibility to do independent reviews of the CSR reporting. So we're actually very fortunate to have with us today Dave Stangas, who is Vice President of Public Affairs and Corporate Responsibility at Campbell's. That means he designs and leads Campbell's corporate social responsibility, sustainability and community affairs and healthy communities initiatives. Since joining Campbell's Soup from Intel in 2008, Campbell's has been named to the Dow Jones and Sustainability Indexes and lists such as the Global 100 Most Sustainable Corporations, the 100 Best Corporations and Corporate Citizens, and the World's Most Ethical Companies. So he's also one of the 30 most influential Twitter voices for sustainability, and he's one of the 100 most influential thought leaders by Trust Across America. So, on behalf of my colleague Megan Ryan, who's on the call with us, and my classmates at Bard MBA, welcome to Sustainable Business Fridays, Dave. Thank you for joining us. And the topic of the day is integrating sustainability as a core business strategy. It's something that's very near and dear to us right now. And I was hoping as a starting point you might give us a brief overview of sustainability as a business strategy at Campbell's before we actually get into questions. So why don't you take it away?
Sure. Thanks, Ian. It's good to be talking to you guys, and the topic's near and dear to my heart. It's one of the things I'm always trying to drive. Just to give you a sense, Ian covered the company at a high level. There's other brands that you may or may not be aware of that are included as well that you may have interacted with recently or in the past, but Pepperidge Farm and Pace and Prego and Swanson, V8, more recently Bolthouse Farms, juices and the dressings and the carrots, Plum Organics, and the most recent Kelsen, which is the Danish butter cookie company in the blue tin that everybody's seen before. My job, what I was hired to do, was really to create a CSR and sustainability strategy for the company. That they've been doing good things for many years, but really to create a strategic framework that aligned our efforts in the community, in the environment, programs in the workplace, as well as trying to drive a strategy and a metric set in the marketplace. So when we talk about it inside the company, we really do talk about building a strategy that leverages what, you know, we may talk on this phone as sustainability, but one that drives, you know, innovation and cost reduction and time to market and better decisions, and that discipline and that realm expands almost every day to procurement and sustainable agriculture. So much of the, you know, at the very highest level, it's setting that framework. We've chosen some very specific directional goals for the next, or for the decade of 2010 to 2020, around energy and greenhouse gas and water and the environment and others and other areas, and then really building the infrastructure and the integration. So it's different in different organizations, but you know, building the process, moving from people that do good work to business processes in procurement, in R&D, in our supply chain organization, and then trying to leverage all the tools that a business has to drive improved performance and integration, from training to recognition to even executive compensation. So there's a bunch of different ways we could take the conversation. I'll let you guys ask your questions. But that's really the high level, the framework, the long-term destination goals to drive change and culture and performance, and then the integration piece, how to actually turn it to business process from just good ideas.
Great. Well, why don't we start with the ideas of growth? I'm very interested in understanding how sustainability helps enhance Campbell's growth goals, its profitability goals. Can you explain a little bit how sustainability enhances those aspects?
Sure. If you kind of put yourself in the, as an MBA student, perhaps put yourself in the mind of the COO or the CEO, and think about, you know, what you're learning from a sustainability perspective and how you're going to leverage those. That's what I'm trying to do as well. So just to pick a couple examples, you know, in procurement, in our purchasing organization, digging into the system about taking a look at the big categories, whether it's ingredients, packaging, or indirect materials, building a sustainability strategy that minimizes the risks that are in the supply chain, you know, finds opportunities around sustainable agriculture or different, obviously we're almost vertical in tomatoes or carrots with Bolthouse Farms, optimizing the sustainable agricultural practices, the relationships with the family farmers to, you know, take costs out of the system, ensure, you know, quality supplies, but also supplies that are on time and meet our timing definitions, taking a look at issues that are of concern to NGOs and activists and our consumers and minimizing those concerns in our procurement supply chain, finding ways to advance more quickly than some of our competitors, lightweighting or recycling or sustainable packaging, and turning those into business processes. Basically trying to find ways we look at the inputs on a total cost delivered basis, as well as time and quality and safety, leveraging sustainability to optimize those indicators, and then taking a look at it, communicating maybe from the marketing standpoint or the business side of the company, moving to another part of the business, and helping our marketers and our folks that are interested in communicating to customers, the retailers that actually buy our products, and then the final consumers, how that might be a business advantage to them, taking secondary packaging out of the value chain so our customers are happier and we're saving everybody money. Some of the things that we're working in the supply chain, you know, that are a customer idea that we can translate into a business opportunity. But it's actually, that's probably what comes to mind first. There's lots of other places this shows up, and from renewable energy to even training our employees as part of new employee orientation, about how to think about sustainability no matter what their department is, how to get involved, what are big strategies and priorities. If you, from a CEO or a COO, if you think about how you want to turn sustainability into an asset in the company, you kind of think about the way work flows, both from a business and then a functional. So what can we do in HR? What can we do in finance? What can we do in R&D and procurement? And then how can we help the manufacturing? How can we help the logistics and transportation, the distribution piece of it, and then how can we help the marketing and sales? So it's a different approach in each one, but that's how we look at it as we're trying to help the company grow.
Interesting. So when you look at sustainability as a strategy, is this a cost item that's added on top of other aspects? Like we're looking at product affordability and the potential, you know, for higher costs for ingredients or ways to make these products. I mean, how are you balancing that with the idea of affordability and maintaining your customer base?
Yeah, it's a double-sided story, right? So if I'm the chief procurement officer, a lot of what I see in sustainability looks like added costs, right? So at least in the near term, if we're trying to put in more sustainable packaging, or, you know, we have commitments around gestation crate-free pork, or maybe we're working on trying to figure out the sustainable seafood in our products, trying to move to sustainable palm oil. These are all things that in the near term are added costs, so we have to work with our procurement organization Nobody wants added costs in the food supply. Our customers don't want it. Our consumers don't want it. And our chief procurement officer, whose basic job is to supply quality ingredients at lower costs, don't want it either. So in that organization, it's a near-term cost that we're trying to minimize long-term risks and position the company better. But, for example, on the supply chain side, on the manufacturing side, much of the work that we're putting in place around renewable energy and water conservation, energy savings, more efficient workflows, are saving money. You know, we've put in projects on the environmental sustainability side in the manufacturing plants that are upwards of $60 million in savings over the last 5 years. So
you've seen some near-term savings then from the investment in sustainability that might offset some long-term costs.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, without a doubt. I mean, the savings from the sustainable kind of infrastructure projects, the capital projects, as well as the savings from sustainable packaging, lightweighting, and transportation, moving from trucks on the road to intermodal. These things have, you know, millions of dollars in terms of savings. So that's what I'm saying. It's not just one or the other. It's how can we help the company across the board. And the other thing is all of the other pieces we didn't talk about. What is it? How much value is it to the company to have a workforce that is thinking a little bit more about sustainability every day? You know, how much value is it to an employee who's more engaged because they're involved in sustainability or corporate citizenship? Those numbers are even harder to get at.
Sure. I mean, we've seen lots of casework in our coursework that suggests that investors might be a bit skeptical of what sustainability might do to the cost base of a company, and as a public company, it's more difficult to implement some of these innovations. Is that something you've experienced, or what has your role as a public company done to your sustainability strategy?
Yeah, it's not a simple answer. I would say that the public company forces us, somebody in my role, or the CFO, forces us to be a little bit more diligent on how we make the case. There's a lot of things that we do and go off and do that we need to be able to explain in fairly strong detail. For example, I just was working with my CFO. We just presented our environmental sustainability kind of annual update to the Campbell Audit Committee, the Audit Committee of the Board of Directors. They have all kinds of questions about, you know, packaging and baseline metrics and data and how much we invest and how much we save, how much is the overall budget for some of these projects. And that's a public company characteristic, right? I mean, that happens because we are a public company. And I think that where the investors are skeptical is when the CFO isn't comfortable explaining it. Not that the CFO doesn't understand it, but if he isn't deep in terms of understanding why the company does certain things, that's where the investors get skeptical. And that falls, I mean, that's my job, is to make sure that my CFO has what he needs to be able to understand it and communicate it. The other thing I think that the being a public company helps, you know, there's a lot of engagement that I do with socially responsible investors. It's part of my job. Multiple times a year, we do investor outreach. We have analyst meetings that are focused on sustainability with socially responsible investors. We talk to share owner advocates on particular issues. They own Campbell stock, but they're interested in particular issues that we engage on. And that's a way to gather more business intelligence and figure out what's coming. It's a way to kind of predict the future in terms of share owner activism. These are all ways that we can come back into the company and help make them smarter, help make them quicker, and predict some of the issues in the future.
Excellent. I know that we wanted to focus some time on impact and innovations. I wanted to throw it to Megan for her questions.
Thanks, Ian. Appreciate it. Dave, I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, environmental and social impact management. Seems to be, like many companies, a key part of the sustainability strategy at Campbell. And I wonder if we could start by talking a bit about the top-line impact goal, which is quite an ambitious one. The Campbell 2020 environmental goal is to cut greenhouse gas and the water footprint of your product portfolio in half. Can you tell us how that's going and if you have any specific examples of really big wins or areas where you came up a bit short that you think would be a good learning opportunity for those of us on the call?
Sure. That's, as you say, a major goal and one that kind of changed the way we think about environmental stewardship and management at the company. If you think about it in simplest terms, it's a decoupling of the company's growth from its environmental impact. So you know, you could double the size of the company and use the same amount of water and emit the same amount of greenhouse gases, or you could stay the same and cut those two things in half. And that's a lot different than continuous improvement, right? That's different than incremental improvement over 150 years of finding ways to conserve a little bit here and there, which is what the company was doing. I would say the biggest change, I'll give you some of the data points in a second, but the biggest change it had was kind of reframing our solution set. So we've gone from a company that used electricity like everybody else on the planet to being the leader in renewable energy in our sector. So we have major project in place at our Napoleon, Ohio, which is our largest soup plant in the world, a 60-acre solar field, 24,000 panels, supplying, it's net metered, it's a tracking system, supplies about 8 to 12% of the power for that plant. To now new projects in place, so we've just put in place a waste-to-energy biogas digester at that plant that not only goes after our waste recycling goal, but takes waste away from the landfill, generates renewable energy, and has a bigger impact on our energy use than the solar field. And we just put in place plans to put in 5 more projects across our North American operations, including solar, wind, and additional biogas. Those solutions were not part of what we would be thinking about as a company. That goal of cutting our greenhouse gas emissions in half put all kinds of new solutions on the table, forced people to really think differently and put in projects that, first of their kind in our industry and for these people that have worked in the sector for a long time. We've reduced the greenhouse gas emissions between 18 and 20% since we started counting. It depends on where you put your baseline. 2008 is what we're looking at now. And last year alone, about a 4% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. So it's an incremental thing. We've still got a long way to go to get to our baseline or get to our goal. Water is a different set of strategies. In most cases, the way I would describe the way kind of water and energy are connected, we're a soup company, thermal processing, in terms of our soup, sauces, and beverages. So water and energy are connected. So if we make some energy efficiencies, we also usually get some water. But we move things around, and with water, it's food. So there's a lot of water used in cooking and transport and cleaning. So water is going to be more of a challenge. We're again, down about, 18 to 20% from where we started. We reduced water use last year 2.6%. We use 1 billion gallons of water less a year now than we did just in 2009. So some huge changes. But there's going to have to be some more, almost like the way we make our product changes to get to that water goal. So that one's going to be even tougher to get to. But I would say the water is going to be a challenge as we kind of move forward. The renewable energy has exceeded our expectations in terms of how fast and how well we've been able to take that on.
Great, thanks. We also wanted to talk a bit about how you're managing your supply chain impacts. We've seen studies that show that for most companies in the food and beverage industry, something like 80% of all of the environmental and social impacts reside in the supply chain. Could you talk a bit about the Campbell approach to managing the supply chain to help meet sustainability goals?
Sure, and that's a huge subject, and for kind of MBAs thinking about this whole business area, the supply chain implications, both from sustainability all the way to ethical sourcing and traceability, are probably the fastest growing. There's kind of more opportunity in that space. Again, few approaches, Megan. I would say the simplest one, the easiest one to approach, is kind of taking our suppliers and not only surveying them with sustainability metrics and questionnaires so we can understand where they're at, which ones we can learn from, and which ones we need to work with to improve, but taking an 80-20 approach, meeting deep dives with 20 of them on whatever category it is, you know, again, packaging, ingredients, indirect, and setting up joint strategies on sustainability, finding the issues, turning those issues into opportunities, minimizing the risk, looking at win-wins for whatever that ingredient or commodity they may be supplying to us. On the sustainable ag area, where we're a little bit more vertical, in, like I said, in tomatoes and carrots, it's really working directly with the farmers. And you'll see a little bit more information as Campbell continues to build our strategy and metrics on sustainable ag. We've got long-term goals there as well. But you can see some of the work out on the website or in the reports around what we're doing with water intensity and fertilizer intensity with our grower relationships and starting to share that information from grower to grower, so that they can learn and benefit from each other. And then there's a lot of work going on in kind of, I would say, industry consortiums, right? So we're members of the Sustainability Consortium and half a dozen other groups that are working on kind of major hotspots in the entire food value chain. You know, we're working on a fertilizer intensity project that involves not just our supplier, but also one of our customers. And there's a lot of examples where that is going on kind of so across the whole value chain. We've done some full life cycle assessments on certain categories to look for hotspots. So when we talk to suppliers, we can talk to them about a specific issue instead of just kind of guessing what we think might be a sustainability hotspot. And like I said, it's the one area that is tremendously growing. And we have a new manager of sustainable agriculture that's been with the company a couple years. And he's taking on a lot of this, and he's a relatively new headcount for us.
Dave, this is Ethan Goodson. I'm going to jump in here just to remind people that if you joined us late, you're with the BARD MBA Sustainability. This is Sustainable Business Fridays. It's the first and last Friday phone call where we talk with top sustainability leaders from across the world. We're talking with Dave Stangus from Campbell Soup today. And if you'd like to ask a question today, you can hit 5-star on your phone, and that will enable you to ask a question later in the call. Ian Edwards and Megan Ryan are two students in our program who are doing most of the asking today, most of the conversation leading, but we'll get you in a few minutes. I want to just jump in with one big question here, which is, it's interesting to see a company like Campbell taking real leadership, especially in terms of, you know, setting really ambitious and science-based goals in some ways for greenhouse gas emission reductions, along with, attacking issues that are more directly focused, around your business model. I'm wondering what is the source of that commitment? Why is Campbell's leading and other companies are not?
Yeah, I'll try to speak for Campbell. I think there's some leadership being shown almost everywhere across the sector, just in different ways. I think, we had the benefit of, or I had the benefit anyway, of working at another company and creating this function from scratch and spending 8 years doing reporting and goal setting and integration there before I came to Campbell. That helped a lot. I mean, it really did help me kind of come in with a mindset. One of the things we did right away was, and it took some negotiation. We talked about it inside the company. We went back and forth about it, but was the setting of these long-term goals. That was not the norm at the time in 2008 when I joined. It's much more the norm now, at least among big companies. And the concept of decoupling growth was fairly unknown as well. People were taking incremental goals. We're going to reduce something 5% or 10%. But what those big goals do for you is the reason I wanted them in place is not only do they let me tell a better story and kind of align people and activity, but they're the ones that drive, those kind of goals are what drive change in companies. Incremental goals don't drive change. They focus a little bit of attention, but they're incremental. It's doing the same thing a little bit differently or doing the same thing a little bit better or maybe just doing the same thing. The goals that are kind of impossible or at the time not well understood how you're going to get there, force behavior change, force people asking themselves questions, and it forces a ripple effect kind of all through the company. And And you see them now. I think that's what we were trying to do at the time, setting them up, and more companies and leading companies are doing that. And I think that's what you're going to see. We're all learning a little bit about how to move this from a kind of a nice-to-do sustainability exercise to really turn it into a business tool set for the company and a set of business advantages. And we're moving it into the corporate citizenship and community affairs realm as well. I know that's not what this call is about, but we're taking that, the kind of metric set and culture change mentality that we learned in sustainability, and we're applying it into other parts of the company.
Terrific. We've got one call from outside, one caller. So if your phone number is 646-221-7307, 646-221-7307, you can ask a question.
Great. Thanks very much, Dave, for sharing these really interesting insights. My name is Dan Sicard. I'm calling from the Clean Tech Group. I had a question going back to supply chain, not so much yours, but you as a supplier or part of supply chain for big retailers. I guess a two-part question. One, how much of what you're doing is informed by some of the pressure you might be receiving from those retailers as they increasingly focus on their supply chain? And then the flip side of that is, you know, to what extent have your ambitious goals really positioned you well with those retailers as perhaps a preferred customer?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's, I'll answer it directly, but I also think there's a perception that there may be more in this space than what's really happening right at the decision-making points. There's no doubt the number of questions and inquiries we are getting from customers about, you name it, and sometimes they don't even know what they're calling it, green products or sustainable products or, you know, green packaging. And it could be food service, right? It could be universities, food service, contractors, but it could be restaurants, but or the retailers that we all know, you know, the Walmarts and the Targets and whatever part of the country you're in, Safeways or Kroger's, Acme's. So there's a lot of that I would say creates activity. People ask questions. It forces some exercise around transparency and disclosure and better understanding and a communication link between the manufacturers, us, and the customers. There are some major efforts, right? Many companies are in partnership organizations like the Sustainability Consortium, you know, that was started originally by Walmart and has continued to be driven by some of their people and some leadership from the companies. And there we might be working on very specific things, you know, specific surveys and questionnaires about what we know about the supply chain and the oil supply chain or the grain supply chain or even the beef supply chain. So there's some work in terms of digging that and kind of opening that lens up a little bit. And in that case, we work hard to really help strengthen those tools. You know, we've given a lot of our purchasing data into that system so they can map out biodiversity hotspots and find ways to strengthen the tools, sharing some of the data we've learned from our farmers into those tools to help learn, to help the system learn. What hasn't happened much yet today is the actual decision-making, you know, the sellers, the salespeople, and the buyers actually weighting sustainability into the purchasing decision in a way that is objective versus subjective or at all. So there's a lot of work that goes on between myself and my counterparts at these companies because we all have them. But the buyer and seller transaction, I don't think we've cracked that nut yet. I think that Walmart is trying hard. I think that it shows up in RFPs. It shows up in, you know, contracts and requests for information. But I still feel it's like informational. We're actually putting sustainability into a formal process we call joint business planning, which is a fairly common term in this sector, to put it on the table when we meet with customers and kind of open it up as a dialogue. You know, where can we help them advance their sustainability goals, and where are we strong that we can be rewarded for our behavior? And it's the same thing our suppliers are doing with us.
Super. Megan and Ian, back to you.
Thanks, Eben. I wanted to turn a little bit towards climate change, and we know that all food and beverage companies, by their nature, are to some degree at risk due to the potential impacts of climate change, thinking about the water issues, Dave, that you already talked about, warming temperatures, potential for increased pest pressures on the crops on which you rely. Is Campbell, you know, hatching any projects to address head-on the risk to the ag supply chain due to climate change, or what kinds of work is underway to start to either adapt to those changes or kind of optimize them?
Sure. Well, many of the things I talked about already, I hope you see as, I don't know that I would position them as kind of reactions to, you know, climate resiliency or something, but they're I would say that they're smarter value chain business decisions and longer term, right? Not just looking at how can I ensure I get my product or my ingredient this season. I view all of those, depending on how you want to describe them, as either, you know, kind of improving the intelligence of the business system or, you know, being more resilient no matter what happens, whether it's weather or climate related. But there's a lot of things that we're doing as part of these industry sectors and really taking a look at where the issues are a little bit longer term, you know, mapping water use worldwide, the biodiversity project I was talking about, specifically in our value chain, in our kind of more vertical value chain, we've launched new projects with our growers to help more growers from you know, traditional or conventional irrigation to drip irrigation, from conventional planting to GPS or precision farming. There's a lot of work that's gone on over the years on integrated pest management. So we find ways to take out, you know, fertilizers or herbicides and pesticides, low tillage work in the fields, you know, water reuse and kind of heat and energy recovery wherever we can touch it in terms of climate change. But I think the other piece that the longer term work that's going on across the sector is bigger. It's more the macro. If you take a look at the planet and where are certain commodities coming from, what are the kind of climate risks that could happen there, and helping the companies think, because the companies in general, the procurement, the buyers, they're thinking shorter term. By design, they've always had to think shorter term. You know, they're worried about getting what they need now, maybe what they need next cycle, hedging those costs, building the relationships, and it's the sustainability experts in the companies that are trying to stretch that time horizon out to think a little bit longer term, make sure that there are more suppliers in the mix, and then educating some of these suppliers on how to take the climate risks out of their supply chains so that they're, you know, they're better quality and they're safer and more reliable suppliers for people like us and our customers.
Great, thanks. I wanted to turn a bit towards innovation and how you're driving your sustainability goals potentially through R&D and product innovation. We saw that in 2012, Campbell opened an innovation center at the Pepperidge Farm headquarters in Connecticut, and the company has stated publicly that it plans to increase investment in innovation capabilities. You guys are using open innovation processes whereby employees and members of the public can submit new product ideas for consideration. Could you speak to how sustainability plays a role in R&D and product innovation at Campbell?
Sure. You know, one of the opportunities that I have, and I don't know that all of my peers might have it, but is sitting with our R&D folks and our innovation folks when we have kind of cross, you know, I would say cross-sector, what we call top-to-tops. So not just with our direct suppliers, but sitting with the executives of the other companies that might be focused on flavors or packaging or other ingredients, delivery, so that I'm in the room. And we're actually, sustainability is part of the conversation. And instead of it being, you know, kind of a happen chance that it would come up in the conversation, actually having it on the agenda so that the, you know, our partners, our supply chain, value chain partners are talking about what they have that's unique from a sustainability perspective that we might not even know about. And then things that we've been thinking about. And this comes across in a bunch of different places, from a very simple exercise of kind of instilling some training or a process step in packaging. So in our packaging engineers put together some training several years ago for them. Basically comes down to awareness and three simple questions. Every time they touch a package, can they make it lighter? Can they make it more recyclable at end of life? And can they put more recycled content in it? So if we're going to make a packaging change, we ask ourselves those three questions. It's a nice, simple way to put sustainability into the business process. And then on the more kind of, I would say, blue sky thinking, is sitting around with executives. We just went through a big exercise with one of our suppliers, really doing what you may know as a materiality assessment, but this one was really blown out in a bunch of dimensions from what's happening on the farm, what's happening in the processing, what's happening in production globally, what do customers and consumers think about it, where is all of the risk and opportunity from sustainability in a business perspective, and at the end, are there ways that we can turn that into a value proposition for both the supplier and the manufacturer, as well as the customer to take to market. So it's taking a look at things, almost bringing a sustainability magnifying glass to the current business process.
Super. Could you talk a little bit about the healthy product innovation that you all have done? The Campbell portfolio includes a wide range of different products that the listeners might be familiar with. And I know that in your sustainability report in 2012, you all reported on, the sales of Campbell products that specifically are in the sort of quote-unquote healthy product category as opposed to others. And that seems to be part of the approach that you're using in terms of embedding sustainability into the business strategy. Can you talk a bit about the healthy product innovation side?
Sure. This was food companies in general are always on this march, and they've been doing it for 100-plus years. But what we did in the report a couple years ago, and we're going to continue it again this year, is this concept of really trying to get some common measures and metrics, even though we're global, right? We've got a pretty good handle on this. The data that we have is kind of U.S. metrics and driving up or improving positives, driving down or reducing negatives, and our product portfolio up to a healthy definition that is a regulatory definition, the US FDA, definition for healthy foods. And then going through and pulling all the nutrition data out of one whole enterprise system, matching that up with the sales and finance data in another system is a huge exercise in our company. It's much more difficult than you might think it is and probably what it should be. And coming up with those metrics, but it was the first time ever that the company has been able to talk about, the sales of healthy products or the sales of products that promote positive nutrition or those that products that help limit, negatives in your diet. And it's a tool that our R&D group is using. It's a tool that our executives are able to use when they talk about it. And it brings a level of transparency, because one business unit can be improving one thing, another business unit can be, working on something else. But this really forces us to bring it together, and it's visible. It's visible internally, and it's visible externally. If we're going in the right direction, everybody knows it. If one year we're going in the other direction, everybody's aware of it. And I think we were all a little surprised at the, some of the numbers that came out in here in terms of, 50-some percent, 60% of our product portfolio having been improved, having improved nutrient profiles over the last several years. It's something that we thought we were doing, but when it took a while to actually see it, and it's a tool that we're using. And the other thing that happens, this is a conversation we can have with our customers, and our customers can help translate their goals around taste, simplicity, number of ingredients, where it shows up in the store, whether it's a center store or a packaged fresh perimeter product, in terms of them helping us understand what they're trying to drive, and then we can fold that into our product development as well.
And it seems like perhaps the acquisition recently of Plum Organics could potentially be something that fits into this strategy. Is that fair to say, thinking about acquiring companies that have a portfolio of healthy products and seeing if there are ways that perhaps the expertise or the supplier base that those companies work with might be able to influence the larger Campbell family of brands?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because it is a great example of how we are changing the business strategy based on our goals, right? So to continue to provide healthy choices in the marketplace, two out of the last three, Bolthouse Farms, which is a kind of a tremendous player in this super premium juice and healthy beverages area, and Plum Organics bring, not only do they bring certain capabilities and expertise, completely different, but we also have things that they can leverage, right? There's things that both of these companies haven't been able to do from a scale or distribution perspective or even a manufacturing perspective that we can help them with. So it really is a win-win. The other thing that many of you may not know about Plum, but I think it's going to be a great case study to watch. They were a B Corp, a benefit corporation, when we purchased them. And they were very interested in trying to be, number one in line to be a incorporated public benefit corporation when Delaware passed its legislation back in August. And talk about getting, something done in a major way, in a very quick way, through a kind of a big corporate bureaucracy. We were able to get this between June and August, get everybody aligned from the CEO to the president of Plum, Neil Grimmer, to the department he works for. So now we have what is really the only one now of a public benefit corporation incorporated in Delaware within a public corporation. And they have the set of bylaws and external mission, much like we have a social mandate and goals, and we're both doing reports and tracking. So it's really going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But you're right, going back to your original question, it is definitely a strategy to help build, that healthy part of the product portfolio and a whole new set of consumers.
Hi, folks. You're with us here at Sustainable Business Fridays. This is a project of the Bar and MBA Sustainability. We have an application deadline for fall enrollment of May 15th. And if you'd like more information about the work we're doing, please drop us an email at mba@bar.edu. Next week, this is the first and fourth Friday call. Next week, we're talking with Tom Holden, who is the VP for Sustainability and Environmental Health and Safety at Pfizer. So we'll be shifting over to the pharmaceutical industry next week with another great conversation. And if your phone number is 917-725-2206, you are live to ask questions.
Hi, Dave. This is Don Carley in New York at the Institute for Sustainable Communication. How are you?
Good. How are you, Don?
Very good. You answered, actually, or addressed the question I was going to ask about materiality assessments and supply chain reporting requirements and how that was going to change, especially with the introduction of the G4 guideline. If you would build on that a little bit, if you can at all, it'd be interesting to see, your thoughts about how that's going to change your role and the role of sustainability professionals. And hearkening back to your earlier days at Intel, one of the very popular topics these days is the Internet of Things, or what we'll call the Connected Revolution. And when you talk about packaging and your supply chains and all of the potential touch points, not only with customers, but of devices or objects that are smart with your network, are there any discussions about how the Internet of Things and connected machine-to-machine communications or object-to-network-connected communications will change the role of sustainability professionals?
Yeah, those are great great topics. The first one, let me just try to address that. I think that the whole world of materiality and not just the work that G4 is doing, whether it's SASB, or I think that the reporting framework evolution aligned with and technology, the way that the companies are reporting differently in terms of trying to make this much more of a story linked to specific audiences versus a book that we expect every audience to kind of deal with, whether it's an investor or a consumer or an employee, that's going to have tremendous, implications for all of us and how we do and the skill sets that have to be on our team. We're trying to take an audience-based approach, ensuring that the investors that need the information get what they need in working closely with the actual people that are doing our SEC reporting, and then trying to build a digital kind of front that lets people engage with us at any moment, at any time, about any piece of data they want. The Internet of Things, I would say, where it does come up more directly, we talk about it all the time. We do these presentations about, you know, kind of digital insights and trends and the way consumers are interacting, both how they're focusing on their health, how they're focusing on technology, how they're making decisions in real time, how and where they're shopping. There's some amazing examples out there that some of you have seen, you know, virtual shopping fronts that people, you know, pick their products from their smartphone, they scan the little codes, and by the time they get home, the package is delivered. This isn't happening yet today much in the U.S., but it's happening in other parts of the world. But I would say, other than in the kind of agriculture and tracking space, I don't see that sustainability has played, you know, a driving role as much as it could, Don, in that space. I think it's the sectors are interesting, jumping from one to the other. The tools that technology brings aren't always seen the same way in the food business as they are in the tech business. I think companies are learning a little bit more, but there's a different mentality around, you know, it's not the thing you make in the technology world, it's what the thing can do for you versus, you know, that's, you know, it's a technology tool and it's about getting to the customer, it's about shipping, receiving, you know, and tracking versus it's not anthropological yet. In the consumer world, we're getting there, but it's not where it could be yet. If that answers, or if that helps explain it.
Great. Since Don has helped to shift our conversation towards future-looking questions, I'm going to hand the question-asking duties back to Ian, who I know has a couple lined up thinking about future outlook for Campbell.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Megan. You touched, Dave, a little bit on reporting, and we've looked at sort of these global trends, you know, Unilever, a European company, you know, opting out of quarterly reporting and other changes within reporting, green P&Ls. I'm just wondering if you look at the trends of reporting and the ways that your stakeholders are needing to be, you know, this information needs to be disclosed to your stakeholders. And what are you looking at in terms of the next few steps in terms of the ways you report?
Yeah, this is, you know, we could spend the next 2 hours on this subject. It really is an interesting topic. And, again, part of this is a personal, this is me speaking from my personal experience in dealing with these different audiences versus, you know, this is Campbell's position on reporting standards. But I do think that the incentives or punishments, whatever the way the system is constructed in the U.S. for companies, you're going to continue to see more sustainability show up in SEC reporting. This trend towards disclosure-based regulations, you know, human trafficking in California, conflict minerals, and the guidance that the SEC is bringing, you're going to continue to see companies proactively and reactively increasing material sustainable disclosure in their 10K and other places. You're also going to see continued advancement and more intelligence in sustainability reporting, corporate citizenship reporting, a more thoughtful approach from the leading companies about what's important, what's material, and why, and here's how we're managing risks, here's how we're developing opportunities, and here's how it's business strategy. Those two things coming together, or major kind of jumps like the Puma example or Novo Nordisk, you know, example of kind of environmental accounting, I still think are going to be one-off. They're going to be companies that are trying to take a leadership position. They're going to be a CEO trying to demonstrate a certain approach. Until the U.S. can get its kind of act aligned around what it wants clearly, not just vaguely, in regulatory reporting and or voluntary reporting and federally across the U.S. versus some state-based or state example, it's still going to be hindered in the U.S. I don't think you're going to see it move other than company or leader-specific examples. And I predict it's going to be that way for a while. I mean, it's going to be incremental, and we're going to continue to put more stuff into the, you know, material sustainability stuff into SEC reporting and strengthen sustainability reporting. But it's going to be incremental until something happens at, I think, the federal or regulatory level in the U.S.
Part of the casework we'll be doing in school is looking at natural capital, the idea of stranded assets, unaccounted for liabilities. Is Campbell's sort of taking a look at some of these things, like what Exxon is doing in terms of reporting stranded assets? Is that a future step also?
I think it's a future step for reporting in the U.S. We look at, you know, we're a big company, but we operate like a small company. So there's two people that are in our department. We're together in the same department, you know. So I own the sustainability reporting. They own the financial reporting. So it's, you know, we meet together. We're in the same group. We kind of, our public affairs and legal are together. So we're always taking a look at what other companies are doing in terms of capturing externalities, the way they're describing their risks in their program or in their report, and talking about how that lays out, you know, how that plays back to Campbell, what things make sense and what doesn't make sense. But so the short answer is yes, but I don't think it's going to, I think the implications of your question are, is that going to drive some major change in the way you use companies are reporting? And I think the answer to that question is no, unfortunately, right? I still don't think we've, as a mandatory reporting framework, set up the system right to force companies to report that way. Shareowner advocates can, you know, there'll be shareowner resolutions and there'll be pressure to move the needle on some of these things, but it's just not. I don't want to say it's fast enough or too slow. It's not set up to do what. Where you're going with that question. I just don't think it's going to happen without some kind of major change in the reporting framework.
So as a way of then of wrapping up this hour, why don't we get a couple of comments from you about what your ultimate vision for sustainability in business or as a business strategy is for the next 5 or 10 years? What should we see from Corporate America and sustainability by, say, 2024?
This concept of destination goals, directional goals, what the future looks like for you name the company in the sector is going to be commonplace. Right? You will see that small, medium, and large companies. One of the things I fear, which is not going to be helpful to a lot of people, is a continued splintering of the reporting. As technology continues to allow us to communicate to specific audiences in real time in almost any way they want that, I worry or I predict it may splinter some of the reporting frameworks that are out there now that have kind of grown up with us. But I think the biggest trend you're going to see is, and you've already seen it start to play out, this movement from doing a collection of good things to defining a specific set of strategies that are actually hung on or built from the business strategic drivers in the company, and then this integration where, you know, I think the best companies today, you could ask the question, you just pick it, you just pull a straw out of a, you know, out of a box and say, tell me what you're doing in HR. And there will be an answer and it will make sense and it will be strategic and intuitive and it will generate long-term shareholder value for anybody that's interested. And I don't care if that's in marketing or procurement or in hiring, retention, new site selection, emerging, that's what's happening today, and I think that trend is accelerating, and that's what I think makes it exciting for people on this call, the MBAs trying to figure out where they can put this to work. It's almost anywhere today, and that's really accelerating, and that's really going to be the future. I think we're going to kind of leapfrog some of the long-term functional organizations, finance, HR, in terms of where we're kind of integrated into business strategy.
Well, Dave, that was a great way to wrap it up. We're coming to the top of the hour. Ian or Megan, do you have one quick last question?
Well, I just wanted to know where Dave might ask or tell us where we should be pointing our efforts as MBA students going out doing business as not usual in the next term. If there's any advice you have for us.
Well, I think you're poking in the right places, right? So this kind of long-term horizon stuff in the value chain, that's the right place to look for risks and opportunities. I just view them as issues. If you screw them up, they're risk. If you manage them better than your competitor, they're an opportunity. But the other piece is this last subject I just touched on. I think that the businesses and business schools today have left tremendous equity on the table by not taking a look at the functionals, you know, the functional organizations, the HR, the finance, the marketing, and building sustainability strategies. You don't have to use the word sustainability. That's probably part of the problem. But leveraging these external and internal trends that we've talked about for the last hour to make those functional organizations, you just accelerate like crazy inside business. And I think that's where, you know, you've got marketing wizards and finance wizards and accounting wizards that also have a desire to drive sustainable business. That's really where I see the future. But I think we've left that equity on the table for many, many years in business schools, and I think that would be a great place to keep looking.
Thank you.
Well, Dave, I want to thank you and Ian and Megan for joining us today. We're at the end of the hour, so you've all been listening to Sustainable Business Friday. Next week at this time, we're going to have Tom Poulton, who is the head of sustainability and environmental health and safety at Pfizer, on the call. So join us at that time at noon, have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you. Appreciate being on the call.
Thanks again.
Oh, and let me just add, we're hoping to this call will be in a podcast form, so if you'd like to learn more or like to hear about it or pass it on to friends, please just drop us an email at mba@bard.edu, and we can send you the link. So have a great weekend, everybody.